Before we start today's episode, I want to give a quick shout out to Zencastr, which is a podcaster's best friend. Trust me when I tell you this, Zencastr is like a Shopify for podcasters. It's all you need to get up and running as a podcaster. And the best thing about Zencastr is that you get so much stuff for free. If you're planning to check out the platform, then please show your support for the Founder Thesis podcast by using this link, zen.ai/founderthesis. That's zen.ai/founderthesis.
Good afternoon. I'm Ranjit Mukundan, CEO, co-founder at Stillabs.
Ek minute ruk jao, ready hone do. Chalo. Ye kar lete hain. This could be a great intro.
The best innovations happen at the intersection of two different spheres. The Indian dairy industry is already the envy of the world thanks to the pioneering work done by companies like Amul, which brought about a white revolution in India. On the other hand, Wipro is the envy of the software world, being among the top three IT companies in India. This is a story of how a bunch of ex-Wipro guys are bringing about a white revolution 2.0 by making use of cutting-edge hardware and software. Stillabs is one of India's largest dairy companies. And you can probably guess from the name Stillabs that our guest today, Ranjit, did not really set out to build a dairy company. He had something else in mind. And this conversation is a fascinating peek into how, by using first principle thinking, Ranjit made Stillabs the most technologically advanced dairy company in India. Here's Ranjit talking about the journey from working at Wipro to becoming an entrepreneur.
I had a good climb at the Wipro career ladder. In those 15 years, when I moved out, I was globally heading Wipro's telecom value-added services and service delivery platform practice, which was a practice under the telecom division. And this practice was all about how do I let AT&T launch its own app store and take on Apple, right? Kind of a practice. How do I let Hungama work on top of an Airtel network? How do I launch more? How do I let this million model monkey thrive? I mean that model is all about on the internet. It's difficult to bet on which app will thrive, right? You just need to let the million monkeys throw things out on the internet and one of them will become a killer app. Right? The whole notion is that if you give a million monkeys
a typewriter,
you get Shakespeare time, right?
It's difficult
to predict. So the notion of killer app didn't exist because we worked on messaging platforms for a long time, right? In 2011, we were so dismissive about a WhatsApp-like stuff. Someone would have come up with a WhatsApp-like idea, I would have said, no way it's going to succeed, right? It's so you don't know until it succeeds that it succeeded, right? So we were very deep into that. So I was heading a practice called value-added services. It's all about putting out platforms and then app stores and things like that can come up. And then one of them will
building
become
a WhatsApp. Ecosystem of developers.
And a platform, right? A platform and ecosystem of developers, right? So that is what I was driving that practice. And that's where the name Stillabs also comes from, because we knew whatever we do, it's going to be an application realm, right? So we knew there has to be an app in the name of the company. So we said Stellar Applications, the domain existed, right? So we said App Store, we looked at Appsery and all that, right? And a nursery that nurtures app.
Appsery.
So finally, we figured that, Stillabs sounds quite hip. We know that our company has to be revolved around applications. But obviously, what we're doing right now is about cows and milk, which has nothing to do with applications. But that's how the name app came into picture. And we decided no matter what we do, applications and not the network will drive the business momentum. Right. And it has to be something horizontal where if you're in healthcare, if you're in education, anyone have to use that application. It has to be like an IoT app store, right? We have to become the Google of IoT, right? That's where the original thought process, Stillabs and all that was, that's the genesis of the whole part. But obviously,
What do you mean by it has to be horizontal? What does that word horizontal imply?
So what we thought was, what we do with applications and the platform, should not be something that's dairy specific, agri specific, healthcare specific, or education specific, or automotive specific. It has to be cross industry, right? That's why we got started in 2010. I mean, I have to build an IoT platform, an app store for IoT that telematics industry could use, and healthcare or a telemedicine industry could use, agri-tech industry could use. So that's where we started.
Automotive could use.
So we started it just by horizontal platform because we were so enthralled by this million monkey model. And we thought that we just need to unleash this model in an IoT framework, right? Because we have seen this model work in the content and the app side.
Your original idea was to build an app store for IoT.
Exactly. That's.
But was IoT even a thing back then?
No, it was not even a jargon those days. So when we started in 2010, M2M was made popular by one of the consulting companies. So it was called machine to machine, wireless machine to machine, right?
Okay.
IoT.
Okay.
So we said we are an M2M. We wanted to actually call it an M2M app store, right? We said we'll build an M2M app store. And then later IoT became popular. And then we said, yes, M2M is IoT. It's an IoT app store. And of course, there's a lot of journey in between. And finally, we are dairy supply chain company today, which is...
Journey is exactly what I am looking for. You know, that journey is the most interesting thing in terms of finding a fit. You know, like finding your market is very important for a founder to do. So, what made you choose the M2M space? Because it must have been tiny at that time, no?
It was very tiny, but it was a in thing, right? So as a techie, you also want to, want to pick the most in thing at that time, right? And the unfortunate thing about a techie is that you're trying to pick the most glamorous tech piece, irrespective of whether it has a business connotation to it or not, right? Because none of us come from a business world, right? We're all techies and we think we're all very famously know about the Google story, right? They went to sell the Google search engine to Yahoo for $1 million and Yahoo refused to buy it, right? They didn't know what they built, right? So we thought even we'll also find one such mojo where we build something and eventually it becomes a few $1 billion. We thought, let's build something very tech, right? Let's build an app store. We'll then figure out the business model later. We'll figure out the monetization later. Build something very tech and geekish, right? And the reason why we picked M2M was that one of the last projects that we did while I was at Wipro was, as I said, trying to build an app store for AT&T. And AT&T was the network, took a big beating because of the relationship AT&T had with iPhone, with Apple, where Apple made all the money with all the apps and all that. And AT&T just became a dumb pipe, right? They give the network. Then AT&T decided, look, if we have to monetize, we have to develop our own app store, right? But you can imagine what a telco trying to develop an app store. Where the story went today. And it was a joint project between Wipro and Microsoft. We were all spending a lot of time in Seattle those days to see how to help AT&T Seattle team build an app store. And the theme of M2M came up. M2M is in world is going wireless, right? All the ports and wired phones are going to go away. So wireless M2M is very critical. And the communication is not just going to be between humans. Medical devices are going to communicate. Vehicles are going to communicate, which Tesla has done a tremendous job on that front. So M2M is going to be an important piece of that platform. And when we dug deeper, we said, yes, this is where the world is going to be. There's a lot of IoT going to be. It's not just going to be the 6 billion humans who are going to communicate. It's going to be those several more billion devices that are going to communicate. And hence, let's build something around that theme. So when we stepped out in 2011, we figured that let's pick M2M as a theme, because we figured it tickled the geekish part of our brain, tickled the tech glamour part of our brain. So let's pick something there. And that's why we decided, let's build, and we knew App Store well. We said, hey, let's build an IoT app store and a horizontal IoT app store. So that's what the trigger, for us, right?
And then the six of you were where? Like, were you all in India, in US, or like?
Yeah, by that time, we had all come back. And though we had left Wipro, we had worked in many other companies. At that point, we were all at Wipro. They were all part of my team, right? So I was heading the team and my co-founder was all part of my team. And we decided, time to take a plunge, 2011. And we decided, let's build out this platform. and let's see which industry to apply it to. So we spoke to folks in medical industry. We spoke to a lot of physicians. We spoke to a lot of surgeons. We spoke to telematics folks like Volvo, right? Decided, would you like your buses to be
monitored? What is telematics?
Telematics is about monitoring vehicles, your car, right? How do I know that you're a better driver than I am, right? And hence, you deserve a better insurance premium than I do because you drive your car better, right? So there are communication interfaces in these vehicles called OBD2 and those interfaces where you could pull data off and I know how many times are you braking? Are you doing a harsh braking or doing accelerating too fast and all of that? And if Volvo were to partner with us, all the buses would be equipped with this cloud-based technology powered by our IoT platform, and they would be able to tell a Volvo bus buyer saying that I can tell you which driver drives better. Is he actually going to sleep at the wheel, right? You know, kind of stuff. So we spoke to a whole bunch of cross-industry guys. And around the same time, one of my Wipro colleagues' uncle, he was starting an organic dairy, right? So he said, you guys are very tech geekish and all that. You're trying to fit things onto cars. You're trying to fit things onto buses, trying to fit things into an operating theater. Why don't you help me use some of those technologies for my organic milk? And we said, interesting idea. Agri and dairy was not on our radar. We actually visited some of the farms, and that's probably one of the first times you're actually visiting this rural India. And the last years, we probably visited a lot more of it, quite a bit, but that was the first time. And it became extremely interesting because we felt that unlike a urban use case, a rural use case actually needs a remote monitoring much, much more, right? Compared to an urban use case. And it's much more compelling because it's to do with livelihood, right? It's not about the ability to switch on and switch off your air conditioner when you're getting home. It's not as compelling. You wouldn't pay for it. But here there are people saying, if I can actually monitor my cow sitting in Bangalore, I'll pay you X rupees right now. So people are willing to leave money on the table. And we figured that from a problem-solving perspective, it helped solve two things from an IoT perspective. One, only way to ever monitor a thing, agricultural component sitting in Bangalore is over an IoT. There's no way you'll have people running behind each and every cow and monitor the cow, right? Probably you would park your car in office, you park your car at home. It's well monitored already, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't spend $1,000 a month to get that monitored.
Needless luxury.
Hmm. Exactly. Here it's quite compulsive. There's no other way to monitor it. Right, that's number one. And number two, we also figured that in these rural villages, there is no sufficient expertise available on the ground to act on those monitored data, right? Because all the good vets, all the good agriculturists have relocated to urban centers, running pet clinics, or are in Australia or the US, you know, doing some farm work there. So we figured that the analytics on the cloud can be a reasonable substitute for lack of expertise in premise, right? Whereas in urban scenario, we didn't find it that compelling. You always had, your surgeon was just a phone call away, right? Your 108 emergency service is just a phone call away, right? And then you get access to best of expertise in Bangalore-like cities, right? Whereas in the villages, expertise has to be rendered differently. So it was called analytics. Those days, machine learning was still not jargon of those days. We said, let's make use of a lot of analytics engines and make this solve for lack of expertise in premise, right? And only way the data is going to come to the cloud is through IoT, right? So these two things fell in place: the lack of expertise in premise and hence analytics, which is now we call AI, ML, and all of that. Right, which evolved, became an in thing. And then IoT is the only way to monitor, right? So we spent a lot of times on those farms, literally living on some of those farms. It's the first time we're actually seeing how animal is milked. Many of us, you know, it's the first time we could actually tell a cow from a bull. We wouldn't know. Right? Now I can talk about, hopefully, someone nuances about milk and cows and all of that, right? It's the first time we've actually figured that milk actually doesn't come from a slot machine in Bangalore. It actually comes from the animals. Right? Because in fact, there are actually one of my friend's brother who actually thought milk comes from slot machines because some of us have bought milk. Right. So we went deeper, spent about a year or two in 2011-12, figured that there's a lot. Then we realized that this, you need capital, right? It can't just be our problem solving part of the brain. How do I build a business model around it, right? And that's yet another journey, right? So we figured that we started a journey by thinking, let me start selling this tech to the farmers, right? So we were very really farm focused. We were trying to automate.
If you like to hear stories of founders, then we have tons of great stories from entrepreneurs who have built billion-dollar businesses. Just search for the Founder Thesis podcast on any audio streaming app like Spotify, Gaana, Apple Podcasts, and subscribe to the show.
What was the problem you were solving to a farmer? Yeah. Like, because you'll have to explain to him in very, very simple language, no? That what is your pain?
Yeah,
that
so when once we had figured out the tech piece, we were exactly trying to figure out what you just asked. What do we now sell? Right, someone has to pay for it, right? It's an interesting problem. Monitoring cows looks interesting. Fitbit for cows looks interesting, but then someone has to pay for it, right? And then we decided, can I then take it to a dairy company, like an organic dairy company, like the company that I mentioned, Akshayakalpa, who are one of the first customer. And can I try two models? One, I'll sell it to a dairy saying, look, if your farmers have to shift the orbit and produce good milk, you need automation at these farms. You need monitoring at these farms. And you need untouched milking of the animals so that the milk can be sold as premium milk, right? So why don't you buy the tech and become a channel to sell to your farmer? Because you see the farmer every day, right? We don't, right? We are a tech company. That was one model we tried. Second, we also started approaching farmers directly through some rural channel saying, hey, farmer, look, you seem to be interested in dairying and I have this tech. This is my pricing. You know, what do you want to buy, right? Then we figured that
The tech, the cows will give more milk.
Exactly. Like, so so the cows, the tech would help you at that point. Now it's a little more different. We have enhanced it. At that point, the key pitch was helping improve productivity and quality. Right.
Okay.
I will, by monitoring the cows, I will tell you, I will help you do preventive healthcare so that instead of sickness management, I will ensure that all your issues are fixed at a subclinical level so that you can save money on veterinary costs, right? You can improve your productivity because if your cows fall sick, they don't give milk to, right? Then quality, I can help you milk the cow without touching the udder, right? Because when you touch the udder, we used to make...
Like through some device.
Okay. Yeah, we used to make automated milking machines, right? Okay. It can just attach itself to the udder and it's a human milking. All over the world, except in India, cows are milked through machines, right? Human hand milking happens probably only in India. In fact, there are tourists who come abroad to see how animals are hand milked, right? It's a tourist attraction. But for us, that's the daily sight for us. So we said, we can help you milk the cows without touching the udder. And by the way, you don't need labor. Even if you have 10 animals, right? You just need one machine. You don't need to hire a laborer because labor was a problem in Indian rural scenario because they would all... You know, either
migrate
and all that, right? They'd come to cities and do other labor work, right? So the value prop is well understood, right? But not everyone is willing to pay based on the value, right?
I want to go a little deeper into the value prop. How would you exactly know that this cow is going to fall sick, for example? Like you said, you will increase the uptime, like you will remove downtime. Due to sickness, how would you know that?
So a couple of ways. One is we had this wearable platform which you could fit as it's like a Fitbit for the cows, right? You could fit it on the cows and you could actually measure the step count, right? A step count is typically indicative. You basically the software will keep a measure of the base step count, right? if it step count keeps trending downwards, you know that something lethargic is hitting the cow. So we may not know what exactly is the disease, but you know what, something. So you would send a real-time alert.
Early warning
signals. Early warning, right? Saying that this cow is slowly less active, and hence it might have. So that then it sends an alert to the neighboring vet or a paravet, and they would go examine. Oh, you're right. This has a hoof infection. Lucky I caught it now. Otherwise, it would have become a clinical infection, right? That is one. And second, we could also measure things like sitting and standing ratio. Typically, cows ruminate when they stand, when they sit, not when they stand, right? So if you measure the sitting-standing ratio, you know that this animal could have a nutrition issue. And then we also had an Android-based application which works in conjunction with this wearable called as a herd management application, right? Which a village level technician could use to enter parameters like when was the animal vaccinated, when is the next vaccination due, when should you do the next deworming, what kind of a nutrition it should be. But these are entered data, not automated, but you can't automate all of them. But you have an app, and then the cloud intelligence then takes over and tells you, okay, if this cow is vaccinated now, next vaccination comes this so and so, and then. It could give you nutritional alerts. It could give you healthcare alerts. It could give you general upkeep alerts, productivity. So all of them in totality tells you how to improve productivity, how to reduce downtime, and most importantly, how do I inseminate the animals at the right time? Because one of the biggest problems for the farmers is that if you don't inseminate the cows at the right time, it won't get pregnant at the right time, and hence, If you don't get pregnant at the right time, it can't give enough milk in that particular year. And hence, it's sort of dry for most of the year, which means it's a cost center for you, right? But it's not producing milk, which is the revenue part, right?
So if cows cow level give data, milk only if they get pregnant.
Just like in human beings, right? So that's it's a higher order ruminant, right? So the biggest problem is how do I detect peak ovulation and inseminate it at the right time? Otherwise,
and cycle how do you know that? Like through that, yeah. how does it fit?
More closer to the 21st day, the activity levels of a cow in peak ovulation would peak, right? Okay. So if you're able to detect this peak, you know that within a four-hour window, you know this is the peak ovulation. And hence, if you inseminate it in the four-hour window, the probability of pregnancy is the highest, right? So in India, people don't use tech, they use telltale signs, right? And what if it's happening between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. when no one isn't seeing, right? Yeah, then you miss some of this peak window. Where tech, you monitor, you measure, right? So these are all the key ways in which you can improve productivity by reducing downtime, by decreasing what we call as an intercalving period of the dry time in the cow, and ensuring that all the general upkeep, happens. So
2011, you quit your jobs. By when did you have this product, like a prototype that you were ready to sell?
Yeah, so by 2013, right, we had the prototypes ready to be sold for the farm side intervention. It included things like automated milking machines, where you could just
probably procured from some vendor.
We designed the entire thing grounds up, because until then
designed it. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a good part about what we did. It was like not just, titillating our software engineering part of a brain, right? It sort of also stretched our mechanical engineering concepts, civil engineering concepts, the electronic engineering concepts, all of that, came to the fore. And then the fundamental sciences of veterinary science and all of that, right?
So you did research. I mean, you had absolutely zero knowledge about
design. Zero knowledge, right? It was zero. So it was like almost redoing three or four times what you'd pick up during an engineering course. You do grounds up, you go look what's happening, you read, you design. And a lot of us had given up our engineering drawing skills, 20 years ago, you re-trigger those. And then finally, we designed something that is fit for the Indian market, right? It's not something that fit for a large farm in the US or Europe. Of course, we borrowed a lot of those principles. So when you look at a lot of PhD theses available on these matters, right? We borrowed a lot of it distilled it down to a farm in a box offering for a smallholder Indian farmer, right? It included automated milking machines. It included things like milk meter that can measure the characteristics of milk as the animal is getting milk. It included early prototypes of a Fitbit for the cows, right? And a handheld platform where you could actually enter all this data. So it's like completely farm-based, like an Android app, right? So this is something that we took to market, took to Akshay Kalpa. It was well accepted.
And you were like self-funded so far, like bootstrap. You were using your savings.
Correct. In 2012, we got funded by IIT Madras because my co-founders at that time were either from IIT Madras or IIT Kharagpur. Right. So Professor Ashok Jhunjhunwala played an extremely supporting role. Right. So we would meet him whenever he's in Bangalore. He used to be on the board of several Bangalore companies like Saskin, State Bank of India and all of them. So whenever he used to be in Bangalore, we used to ride along with him from the airport to the city. And good that the airport shifted. You could use that time to get some good meetings. So then he said, look, you guys are trying to do something fundamental that is needed in the Indian agriculture. I think he used to be part of the Prime Minister's Advisory Council for Agriculture at that time, I think. So he said, why don't you guys get incubated at IIT Madras? We have something called as an incubation cell. And we can also give you some money because you need a few more people to help you. We'll give you some. So they enabled some equity, soft debt all put together, maybe about 50 lakhs, kind of money. That plus our own bootstrap savings, each of us, put in about 25 lakh each to that extent, plus that 50 lakh. Plus, we also raised some money from friends and family. We went back to our Wipro colleagues and said, we're trying something exotic and interesting. And given our track record in Wipro, the people willing to bet their money on us. So we are eternally thankful for people who bet on us. So 50 lakh from IIT Madras, about 1 crore from sweat and our own savings contribution, another crore from the friends and family, including IIT Madras alumnus and our Wipro, ex-Wipro colleagues. We got access to a couple of crores of capital, which kept us going till 2013. So we were sort of IIT Madras funded, friends and family funded, self-funded till 2013. In 2013 is when I ran into Mark Khan of Omnivore, which was probably the only ag tech fund at that time. Right.
Okay.
So I ran into him at one of the conferences in Delhi, and he got quite interested, saying that, look, we are ag focused and dairy is ag. Right. I want to look at how your early prototypes are working, what you guys do. So he flew down to Bangalore. He went along with us to some of the dairy farms where we were trialing some of our solutions. And he said, yeah, this seems to have a lot of legs. Is there something like a business plan that you have on how this can scale and all that? And that's when we did a few night outs and did all the work on the Excel sheets on, this is the total addressable market, this is the promise. And finally, they did their first institutional fund in us in July 2013, right? So from 2011 to 2013, we ran with our own bootstrap capital, IIT Madras money, and the friends and family money. In 2013, July, Omnivore, gave us a check of about 7 crore at that time, which was the dollar was about 45 those days. So it was about $1.5 million, which felt like a lot of money those days. We said, with this money, we should break even. But now I realize how wrong we were. We said it's a lot of money. So we should go IPO with that money. Decided. But then once we started getting into the market and solving the problem and our business models continuously shifting, right? Several mini micro pivots happened.
Tell me about that evolution, that whole journey of finding the product market fit.
Yeah. So very soon we realized farm-only approach is not working. Either the farmers felt that, right, for several generations, they are milking the cow. They understand the milk. They understand cows and milk the best. Why should they buy for the tech? So we couldn't get the value-based pricing out of the way. And number one, and selling things in a retail fashion to these dairy farmers, we found it's not a scalable in approach, right? And then we started looking
because the customer acquisition cost would be too
customer
high.
Customer acquisition cost is very high.
So much traveling,
channel costs. And if it's an urban scenario, at least the ARPU, the average revenue per user, is high, right? But right. In a village scenario, how much can you ask a farmer to buy? And these are smallholder farmers. 80 million smallholder farmer dairy farming families, right? That's roughly the size of US population. But then how much can they pay, right? So we decided that value-based tech pricing in a retail fashion to an agri farmer is not going to work, right?
And then what pricing did you have at that time?
Yeah, so it would sort of, we tried a per cow pricing. We said, you know, 200 rupees per cow per month. We tried a monthly rental at a herd level pricing.
Okay, right? And you had to pay some telecom cost, I'm assuming. Because
we had to pay for the telecom cost, correct. The data has to come out.
Fitbit devices would have some SIM in it, right?
Correct. So the Fitbit would actually send data to a central device, a solar-based device, so that you could multiplex multiple. So we used an unlicensed spectrum, for that. Called 6LoWPAN, right? It's a power efficient wireless mechanism called 6LoWPAN that was actually made popular by Google when they acquired Nest.
So that's
a very power efficient. These were the days when.
This was like a Wi-Fi mechanism.
The Mac layer is actually the 802.11. That's the Mac layer. It just that the layer on top was more evolved for battery efficient working. And the low power Bluetooth wasn't very commercial those days, right?
Now,
in retrospect, if I do it today, I would have probably used BLE because low power Bluetooth is quite commercial and quite affordable. Those days, 6LoWPAN seems to be the right choice to make. So it would send to a central part, and that SIM cost would also kick in, right? And then how do I charge it to the farmers? I need to charge the hardware part, the cloud part, the communication part. So we tried various models, some CapEx, some OpEx, some cloud, some hardware, because there's a hardware element also involved.
But we couldn't
find the right model that would give us a flywheel effect and where we can scale rapidly, right? We knew the market is huge, right? There is 80 million smallholder farmers, right? 7.6% of our GDP was dairy, right? 300 million cattle, right? Producing, 560 million liters of milk per day, right? Milk is, if you consider milk as a crop, we knew it was the single largest crop on the planet, right? But how do you monetize this was a difficulty because all of us were looking at it from a tech-only angle, right? We were not looking at it from a business and commercial and a monetizability angle, right? Then once we figured that we're not able to get that flywheel effect going because of all the friction points, we stepped back and then started taking a supply chain view, right? We said, look, I can't just solve the problem only at the farm. I need to sort of solve the problem of milk from the udder to the consumer because finally, it's you and I who finally the guys who pay, right? If I give you an antibiotic free milk, you probably pay 10 bucks extra because you can very comfortably give it to your kid at home or give it to your parent, right? Since you are the ones who are paying, right, I need to tap into your wallet share, right? And then we figured out how do I tap into your wallet share? It's a farmer's wallet share, right? Farmers should probably benefit from what you pay, right? And so then we figured that I need to take a supply chain view. I need to sort of solve for the supply chain. And we figured that there are two components to the supply chain, right? One is the market linkage part, right? How do I take milk as an output? And when the milk comes to you, I need to make a buck or two when Akshay pays extra for the milk, right? How do I get to that? How do I tap that loop? The second loop is farmers do buy cattle nutrition, soil inputs, feed, seeds, and a lot of things. They need capital to grow their own herd size, right? They need financial capital, they need insurance and all of that. So this is another part. And that the agri input results in that output, which is milk, right? So we said, these are the two points, two ends of the barbell where I can actually make money. And tech should power this, right? Tech should enable this. So we shifted from the mindset of trying to license tech and make money out of tech. tech actually powering the supply chain, and we're monetizing the supply chain in a component, which is agri inputs and the market linkage, right? So that's when we step back and said, yes, I need to sort of build out my stack, which is a farm only stack, to make it a supply chain stack. And hence, we in 2014, we from 2013 to 14, we took 1 year to launch a product for the supply chain part, which is the collection center where you do trading and pricing, right? So we launched a product which could help you do grading and grading, pricing and payment for milk, right? So when a farmer comes to sell the milk at a collection center, you could grade the milk, you could price it, and you would actually do a payment, a direct farmer payment into the farmer's handset. So you're literally converting milk into currency, right? And then we figured that milk is perishable. The next part of the supply chain is cold chain. I need to optimize cold chain. Otherwise, if you're trying to make Kanazawa grade cheese, your raw milk is not great, right? You would only get pizza grade cheese, a mozzarella cheddar. You can't make Kanazawa grade cheese. We said cold chain is important, right? And then we figured that till the time it reaches the plant, I need to maintain supply chain integrity because it's a very rural phenomenon. People can take good milk, pour water and all that, right? So we started launching between third. Once we figured that it's a supply chain play in 2013, we started launching products for all parts of the supply chain, the collection center, chilling. So it took about till end of 2014 for us to have different pieces of enablers that take data from those parts of the supply chain, put it onto the cloud, and on the cloud, we start cross-correlating data across the parts, including the farm, right? And then the notion of traceability kicked in, right? So when we started, it was only a productivity and quality proposition. Then we said, now we have three pillars of value prop. It is P, Q, and T, productivity, quality, and traceability.
Right.
Earlier, traceability, and I'm using the term traceability very loosely here, right? It's traceability
like
is about
geographic.
Yeah, how do I give you antibiotic-free milk, right? How do I know that if you scan the QR code on the yogurt that you eat, how do you know that it has undergone tests all throughout, right? It's just not an audit-based assurance. It's actually a test-based assurance, right? So that if you want to give pesticide-free milk, adulterant-free milk, if you want to do cheese that has undergone certain tests along the way, how do I give the assurance so that when you scan the QR code on that pack of yogurt or on the pack of ice cream, you know that the ice cream's, the milk's journey has been, right? You should virtually be able to trace it back to its roots, which is the farm or a cluster of farms, and say, yeah, something goes wrong. I know these are the group of farms that contributed to that good thing or the bad thing, right? So traceability became a very, you know, big thing. And that we found was very nicely monetizable. Right.
So, right. Were you making these products to become a supply chain player or to sell to supply chain companies like these dairy?
To sell to supply chain companies.
Okay.
That was
okay.
Another mini pivot, right? So, first okay. We started with, once we figured that supply chain is the way to crack it, initial part of the journey in 14, 15, even right up to 2017, was about trying to sell the supply chain components to the dairy process and say, look, we will give you tech that can help solve for P, Q, and T, right? You could then use it to launch antibiotic-free milk. You could then use it to launch dynamically traceable milk, right? So right up until 2018, right up to just before COVID kicked in, it was all about trying to sell the supply chain. 4-5 years we spent in selling these tech so that someone else can use it, right?
Okay.
And that's when we figured that it still had friction. The friction point was that majority of the dairy processors in India look at milk as commodity, right?
Yeah.
They don't look at milk as nutrition,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So their margins are very wafer thin.
Yes.
Commodity margins
yes.
are very wafer thin.
Yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
And if they try to sell something that is premium, it would cannibalize their commodity business because high volume, low margin business, right? So they still didn't have the mindset, not the business model to sell differentiated products, right? It's like if you've been running a no-frills aircraft for a lifetime, right? You just can't think of a Vistara, right? You just can't think of the Vistara model, right? So we figured that. And the people who are willing to see value in it are very niche, like an organic milk company. That would have let us scale, right? Organic milk is a very small sliver, right?
But they would be single digit percentage.
Single digit percentage or even lower. So we figured that until we launch our own business operations, right, and demonstrate how this tech stack can be used to power a brand like an ITC or a Coke or a Britannia, who have the brand to sell nutrition into the market, branded nutrition into the market, not just commodity milk, right? We need to do that, because someone like an Amazon Fresh or a Swiggy or a Zomato, right, wouldn't want to sit in Begusarai, Samastipur, Munger and run operations and procure milk, right? They want to take great quality milk into the market in the form of cheese or butter or whatever. And then they would use the BB Royal brand if you're a big basket. They would use a Fresh to Home brand or a Licious brand to sell that branded product, branded dairy category to a consumer, right? So then in 2019,
We come to this pivot, I'm slightly going back a bit. So these individual devices that you made for the supply chain, can you like go into detail on those? Like, say you made a device for grading of milk. How did that work? Like, you know, I want to understand how you went about building each of these components.
Absolutely. So for grading the milk, typically the milk is graded using an ultrasonic IoT device called a milk analyzer, right? The milk analyzer would take a sample of milk, and taking the sample of milk, it would give out electronically. It could tell you what's the percentage of fat content, what's the percentage of SNF, is there any adulterants in it? Is there any somatic cell count in it? It would give you all those data. So we get the data out into our IoT router, and the router sends it to the cloud. And in the cloud, we run analytics. How is the farmer's milk quality trending, right? And how do I cross-correlate it with the data coming from the farm? At the farm, if there's an antibiotic intervention, this particular farmer's milk would be collected separately in a separate can, right? So we would maintain a mapping of cow ID to farmer ID mapping, right? And farmer ID to sample ID mapping. And the sample ID would tell you what the sample readings were. And then the dairy process would decide, okay, if the sample quality is X, right, and the quantity is Y, I can pay him this much money, right? And
so
the money
this
that
is
they
like
need
a
to pay,
UV scanner, like
no, you would actually need to take a sample. You would actually need to take a sample from the farmer's incoming farmer's milk, and you sort of it's a small sampler, and you need to fit the sampler into a milk analyzer.
Okay,
right, and then the milk analyzer would sort of suck a portion of this milk in. And using ultrasonic technology, it should come back and tell you what the quantity is. Right? Okay. Today, of course, things have moved on. We're trying to see if we can move to a spectral analyzer, which is more powerful. Those days, ultrasonic itself, IoT-fying an ultrasonic sensor was itself a big thing. But today, the analysis has moved to, can I do this using spectral analysis at a very affordable village level, so that village level analysis can be done at affordable spectral. So we're still exploring.
So spectral analysis will give you more data as compared to UV? Like
more data, more quickly. Yeah, can give you more data and more quickly.
Okay.
Right? And you can measure a lot more. The spectral signatures can detect a lot more things far more quickly because ultrasonic can at most tell you one or two or three things. Right?
Okay.
Fat, protein and all that. Whereas spectral fingerprints can give you lot more things, how much of urea was added, right?
Okay. It'll give you like a complete chemical composition.
Complete profile, right? It's like a blood test result, in fact, right? Mm-hmm. How much of vanaspati was added to beef up the fat content, right? It could catch, because ultrasonic sensors had a limitation in that it could only give you primarily the composition of milk. It couldn't give you the complete adulterant and the contaminants of the milk. Whereas the spectral analysis can do a lot more quickly.
Right.
But even today, the technology, the commercialization of this is still taking a while because it's still expensive, right? I need to make this work at a village level.
Right.
Not at a lab level. Why is it convenient for a blood test? Because it's a lab level function and I can amortize the cost across thousands and lakhs of people walking in. Whereas at a village level, you have only 100 farmers walking in, right? So the costs have to sort of, working at it. So that we're trying to see, can we now use those innovations sort of here? So that's basically how that piece of the technology works.
What other components did you develop?
Yeah, so that was one. And the second was that there are several peripherals at a collection center. For example, there is a simple old-fashioned weighing scale, right? The weighing scale data has to come wirelessly to us so that the quantity can be measured through a weighing scale. And then we put a display device at the collection center so that all the farmers standing in the queue has a transparent view of how much the other farmers, how the other farmer are performing, so that there becomes a healthy competition among the farmers. If that farmer is getting 10 rupees because milk is better, I should probably do that, right? And then we introduce the notion of an ID card for the farmer. So when a farmer walks in, you scan his ID card so that uniquely you could identify that farmer and you associate a unique ID card. Right? So it became a farmer, a unique farmer ID. Internally, we could actually map it to another system. We could map it to a mobile number and all that. But externally, it's a simple ID card. So that the farmer's loyalty to the dairy improves and all of that. Milk quality assessment, weight assessment, right? Transparent display of whatever is being performed there. And finally, on the cloud side, integration with the back-end payment systems, right?
Okay.
Because the farmer would have some
bank account.
Right? How do I do a DBT, direct benefit transfer to the farmer's account, right? So that needed a lot of, that's where our fintech part of our business took off. We then realized that in India, we disburse about $25 billion worth of payments to the dairy farmers every single year. So there is money made to be, money can be made on payments. Money can be paid made on lending to the farmers, right? So it opened a whole new vertical, which today we call as MuPay, where we are trying to see, it's a separate subsidiary, where we are trying to see, we never had an idea that it could result into that. But when we started IoTifying payment data, we result, it can result in payment. And then we started seeing payment data. We said, yeah, payment data is helping us get into the lending space. And hence, we could start. So it sort of gave rise to a whole new vertical internally, which today we drive as a separate vertical, separate subsidiary internally, right? So that was one measurement that we did at the collection center. At the chilling center, which is the next part of the supply chain, we started measuring using a volume sensor. We started measuring the volume of milk, how much milk is there in the bulk milk cooler. In the middle of the night, are people pulling out good milk and adding, you know, not so good milk into it? So there's a sudden fluctuation volume. We know that some hanky-panky is happening in that milk. Is the milk getting under-chilled or over-chilled? So we integrated a temperature sensor into it. We integrated a mechanism to measure the energy consumed, because in India, we still spend about 500 million liters of diesel every single year to chill milk, right? Because not all of these villages are electrified. You don't run it on. We probably consume about 2 billion kilowatt hours of energy in chilling milk. Right? How do you optimize it? So though our primary focus was on quality, there are other collateral benefits like, can I chill milk more in an energy efficient manner? Can I contribute to the carbon footprint emission reduction? Right? I burn less diesel to chill more milk. Right? So we integrated about 5-6 sensors to ensure that the cold chain protocol is efficiently monitored. And since we are also measuring the quality and quantity at the collection center on a per farmer level, when that milk comes in into the chilling center, if at an aggregate level it doesn't add up to the per farmer level measurement, we know that along the route some issue has happened.
Right.
Someone has removed. So you could actually in real time catch the issue, penalize the right person, saying that your can is supposed to have so much, but when it came, it does not have so much. So I'm not going to accept this can, or I'm only going to pay you so much. So since you're catching these things in real time, people's compliance goes up quite a bit. All right? We call it supply chain integrity, right? So we started measuring some of those. And then once finally that milk goes out from the bulk milk cooler, where milk is actually chilled, into a milk tanker, you again maintain the mapping, right? Which bulk milk coolers, milk has gone into which tanker and which tankers, which compartment, so that finally when the milk reaches the plant, you know for sure that what you're accepting is what the farmer actually poured several hours ago in a remote village, right? So all of these measurements started coming to our cloud, which could help us finally tell how do you improve productivity, quality, and traceability. And as I was saying, right up until 2019.
Again, before we come to that pivot. So you must have got you must have been co-building these components with dairy customers, right? I mean, you must have got some paying customers with whom you were co-building these components, like.
Absolutely. So the supply chain business was quite a compelling business. It still is selling tech to people who run supply chains. We have deployed our systems in about 35,000 points of presence in India.
Okay.
And these are 35,000 villages, right? And these are real remote villages. We have about 300 people in the company whose focus is to provide support and maintenance for these deployed hardware, right? And these are today deployed in almost all the dairy companies in India, right?
Okay.
You pick the large cooperatives, Amul deploys it, Nandini in Karnataka deploys it, Sudha Milk in Bihar deploys it, Britannia deploys parts of it, ITC deploys part of it, Hatsun deploys it, several large and small dairy teams. So we have about 250 dairy processors in India who deploy our systems, right? This was a result of these deployments that happened between 2014 and 19. But our whole point was this entire tech stack.
This was not growing fast enough, or
It was growing. It was still growing, but we always knew that given our telecom and app store background, we knew that we still knew that this digital access network is still the platform piece, right? The flywheel million monkey piece impact is still not taking over, right? So we're always looking at ways in which this digital access network that we've built across the dairy supply chain, which is deployed across 35,000 villages, how do I get that flywheel effect to sort of kick in, right? And who will pay for those value-added services, right? If the dairy processor for whom we're supplying technology, if they themselves are making, let's say, 30 paise per liter, right? How much will they pay for the tech part, right? If I want to make high value margins, I need value-added services to kick in. And the value-added services payment has to be taken care by you and I paying more for it, right? So that's when we figured that in 2018-19, there's sufficient growth happening, but I couldn't shift the margins significantly higher.
Right.
So we shifted from a horizontal land grab business model, which is keep adding more and more farmers, keep adding more and more milk flow. We were at that point digitizing about 13 million liters of milk flow per day, right? By virtue of which we were probably the second largest in the country after Amul, in the amount of milk flow that we get to touch on a daily basis, right? But it's just that they get to touch it physically, we get to touch it digitally, right?
But this was not your milk flow, but this was like your customer's.
Correct, milk flow. Exactly. It customer's milk flow. But just that we grade and price that milk flow, right? We ensure the supply chain integrity for the milk flow, but it was not our milk, right? It's someone else's supply chain, right? And all the 13 million liters of milk flow that we were touching at that point were predominantly being sold as commodity milk, right? So I couldn't get the flywheel effect kick in. I couldn't get the margins kick in.
We
knew that we had enough volumes so that where we can sit back and say, okay, I'm the second largest in the country today after Amul, right? But I didn't get that's when we started getting towards the next part. I wouldn't call it a pivot, but we figured that the only way to get the operating margin part to kick in is to get more and more vertically integrated, right? So that I have to getting more and more vertically integrated. I have to become the Uber, right? I just can't be the guy who's giving the taxi to the Uber. I have to become that Uber, right? Where Uber gets paid for every hail or Ola gets paid for every hail. I need to get for every liter. The only way to do it is getting more vertically integrated, where I need to run the business operations.
Right.
And then go back to this dairy and say, hey, look, why are you actually running your operations? Right. I can actually run it for you. You have built a brand. Why aren't you better off leveraging that brand and then selling it? And by the way, I'll help you launch multiple brands now. One can be antibiotic free. Right. And by the way, if you are Britannia, your brand is well recognized in India. Right, and you might actually want to run it. So we would actually be your backward integrated player. I would be your Intel inside. You become the Dell, right? I would become your Tetra Pak, you become the Tropicana, right? That became the pitch, which was really well accepted by the market, because almost every FMCG player, almost every D2C, direct to consumer player, wants to launch dairy as a category. But they have no clue in how to launch a differentiated product that you and I are willing to pay for more. And even if they knew, for them sitting in Begusarai, Samastipur, Munger, Sharanpur, you know, Chania, Chandoli, and procure that milk in the remote villages, which is next to a forest in a tribal area, and bring it to your Mumbai city or Delhi or Bangalore is virtually unthinkable, right?
Right, yeah.
But we have sort of done that for the last 10 years, right? And we have visited thousands of these villages now. We have 800 people today who, you know, eat and breathe milk in these villages, right? So it becomes like a very good offering on the platter for an FMCG brand, right, who is now trying to launch these differentiated products to this aspirational India, right? So we have about 25 to 30 million households in India that contribute to 65% of the FMCG value. We are the guys who are willing to pay, you know, shift from maybe a Maruti to a Toyota or a Toyota to a Civic or a Civic to something else. We are the guys who are willing to pay, click and buy something that is antibiotic free because we think our kids prefer this. We are the guys
kind of people who would buy Tetra Pak milk.
Aspirational segment, right? Yeah, Tetra Pak milk. Right? Yeah. So these are the guys who wouldn't mind paying 10 bucks more per liter. In this industry, 10 rupees more per liter is a huge amount of money because you apply it to millions of liters, right? Because the good part about India is almost the entire 1.3 billion people consume milk, right? In some form or the other. So on one end, you have 80 million farmers produce this milk. Other end, you have, you know, 1.3 billion consumers who consume this. We sort of said we'll become the digital proxy to enable, connect the two. 80 million farmers on one end.
You'll build the pipe, basically.
We'll build the pipe and it becomes we'll build that multi-service supply chain. That is, I'll build a supply chain on top of which you could run a Deccan Airways or you could run a Vistara, right? Obviously, our preference is to run a Vistara, but not everyone will buy. Not everyone are first-class passengers, right? You'll have economy class, you'll have economy plus. So we will build that pipe wherein you could take an economy class trajectory, extra legroom trajectory, first-class trajectory, and a business-class trajectory.
You decided you want to build the pipes. So this would mean that you would then start paying the farmer from your pocket. And then you would sell it directly to a Britannia, take the money from them. That whole money would flow through you.
Exactly. So, this is when we figured that, one, since I'm building the pipe, I'm building the highway myself, I'm building the infrastructure, right? I better enable people to sell differentiated products. And these are people who hitherto had the muscle power to sell differentiated products, but didn't have access to the raw material.
Right.
I enable them with the raw material. And second, this also gave rise to an option where to make sure that the pipes are efficient, right? I need to make sure that the smallholder farmers can't remain smallholder, right? They need to shift from a 5-liter orbit to a 200-liter orbit. For that, they need all the inputs to do that, right? And these are farmers who didn't have access to all the inputs, right?
But why did this matter to you? That
because
to make a
the supply liter. Chain efficiency goes. Yeah, that's when our unit economics will look better because I would rather collect more amount of good milk from fewer number of farmers than large set of farmers, right? So my supply chain efficiency improves.
But and you have the tech in place, it doesn't matter much, right? Like, I mean,
the tech in place, but since I'm also taking on the operations now because I'm building the pipe, I'm running the operations, I would rather on a per head basis, I would rather. Make sure that every personnel is able to handle 1,000 liters of milk instead of 100 liters of milk.
Got it. Okay.
So that I'm able to better leverage my fixed and variable costs, right? My unit economics will start working better. And for these farmers, to make the unit economics work better, number one, they need access to capital, right? Because otherwise, they don't get loans from a State Bank of India or an ICICI.
To buy cows.
To buy cows, right? Because one, how do you underwrite risk?
Right.
They don't have a
credit history.
So we started using the data to develop things like a Moo score. We came up with something called as a Moo score that helps you assess the farmer's credit worthiness better, right? Because 60% of the farmers have never taken any form of loans, any form of formal loan, right? So we are actually trying to patent it. We have actually 6 or 7 patents.
How do you score a farmer on credit worthiness? Like, is it on consistency of output or?
So right now what we do is we get an assessment of the milk quality, right? We also get an assessment of the farmer's cash flow because we know how much
you're paying
the farmer.
We
are paying him. So cash flow becomes pretty important to decide, do I give you a 10,000 rupee loan or a 30,000 rupee loan? I get an indication of your loyalty. I get an indication of your churn, right? So, and then I also get an access to the asset data. What is a farmer's biggest asset? It's its cows, right? I get the asset data. And then I also get a feel for his psychometric because I know if the farmer is, how compliant is he to the vaccination protocol? How compliant is he to various? So he's a little more progressive farmer compliant. So I use a combination of this data to decide, one, what kind of a loan product can he absorb? When is the right time to give him a loan? And what kind of a risk I'm taking? So that's broadly how this Moo score works.
Got it. Okay.
And today I have partnered with a whole bunch of banks where I actually do almost end-to-end risk underwriting. But I use, I'm sort of a business correspondent of that particular bank. Right, and farmers get access to more formal credit, and banks get access to these new set of borrowers who they never had access to. Right, and these are not
which would help banks meet their priority lending quotas also.
Priority lending goals and all of that. And these are not SHG loans or these are not microfinance loans. Right, we get to see the farmer every single day, twice a day. Right, because milk is a daily velocity product. It's not a seasonal product like a potato or a tomato. Right. If a farmer doesn't turn up into a collection center on a particular day, someone gives him a call saying, hey, what happened to you, right? So it's not like I get to know that at the end of the month he has not repaid and hence there is some issue, right? So we are able to help underwrite. It's sort of a lend and monitor type of an approach.
Yes.
Not a lend and forget
kind of approach. Yes.
I'm also able
to do the collection from what you're paying him, like some percentage.
The farmer payment, exactly. Exactly. So it's almost like you're having access to the farmer's salary account. And hence, I'm able to detect things from the source, right? So this is how this entire scenario works, which initially when we started, we had no clue for. But then we realized we have all this data. We have the Moo score kicking in with the payment data and all that. So that sort of gave rise to a whole new billion-dollar vertical types internally, which we're trying to nurture, which is like a fintech vertical. And then the market linkage is another vertical where we go to the Britannia's ITC's of the world or Amazon's version of the world, the Cokes of the world and say, I can help you launch better milk, better cheese, better paneer or whatever. And then you had the agri input part of the business where I figured that these farmers also need nutrition, animal nutrition, right? If the farmers, so I started partnering with a lot of these agri input providers, with cattle nutrition being the first one, where we said, we make some commission from selling these agri inputs to the farmer, right? So now I have 3 revenue generating streams, which we had no visibility to when we started. One is of course the tech block, which continues to power our own captive supply chain and third party supply chain. Then you had the fintech block for payments and credit. Then you have the market linkage block where I power a third, where I take milk to a Britannia or an ITC or a Parle or a Coke or a Swiggy. And then I have the agri input part where I'm partnering with folks like Nutrico, which is, for example, a Dutch nutrition provider who used to make very high-end cattle nutrition products, which our Indian smallholder farmer never had access to, right? Now, suddenly, the Indian smallholder farmer have access to a Western European cattle nutrition product. And someone like a Nutrico, who actually came on board as an investor recently, have access to all of these farmers, and they don't have to worry about how to collect the money back because we can collect the money digitally.
Right.
These are the 4 towers that currently we have given rise to, and they are very interrelated, right? Because at the end of the day, it's market linkage, right? But to ensure that my differentiated premium market linkages work, I also need to provide agri inputs, including financial services.
Yes.
Otherwise, my
yes.
supply chain is inefficient.
Right.
And then tech has to power, you know, all of this. Otherwise, it's going to look very brick and mortar. So for us, milk is an incidental outcome of a well-designed digital supply chain, right? It's not a dairy product. It's an outcome of a... And since it's a digital highway that we have built, now we can now think of what else can I do? Can I bundle insurance with credit, right? Like, why not give other soil inputs like fertilizers, other things to the same dairy farmer, because the same dairy farmer also is growing other cash crops.
Yes.
So now that we have this digital pipe built in and we have the model built in for agri inputs and this output, right? I'm trying to get more and more vertically integrated. And this is where my flywheel has started taking off. I'm now seeing that my revenues have started, you know, spiraling up because it's just not the tech licensing SaaS revenue. That's just one component of it. I have the commerce revenue kicking in. And I also have the unit economics kicking in, the contribution margins kicking in, mainly because I'm able to leverage my fixed cost and the variable cost much better. Because India being India, different regions behave differently, right? Eastern UP behaves differently from Kolar, right? So unless I perfect this cluster model, right, and make sure that each cluster is, I'm sort of thinking demand backwards, right? The demand backward thinking becomes extremely important.
What is
right?
demand backward Otherwise, thinking?
Demand backward thinking is if I know that Coke wants to launch antibiotic-free milk in Bangalore, right? I need to have a modular cluster that supports that customers in Bangalore because Bangalore can pay for it, but maybe Erode may not be able to pay for
yes,
it, right?
Yes.
So I can't. So typically in India, the traditional dairy supply chains have been built with a supply forward thinking to solve for the availability problem and the quantitative sufficiency problem, right? I still remember standing in queues to buy milk, right? Because availability problem was availability itself was a big deal, right? But now that the availability problem is solved by building the supply forward supply chains, a time has come to think demand backwards. What type of milk, what product, and who are the consumers who pay 10 rupees extra for that product, right? There could be cheese lovers in Delhi who swear by buffalo cheese, milk cheese, right? And they are willing to pay, why 10 bucks, even 50 bucks more, you know, for that cheese. How do I build backwards from there? So we started, and Ashirwad brand is well known in all the cities, right? But why isn't ITC Ashirwad having dairy as a category in every city they operate in? Why is it they only have Atta? Why is it that they only have pulses? It is just that they don't have access to these modular supply chains who can help them pan India, right? And if you're an Amazon Fresh or a Swiggy or a BB Daily, you would rather want to launch a product in 20 cities because all the 20 cities have pockets of Bangalore-like customers, right? And hence, I am able to tap into that in one go. So that's what I mean by demand backward thinking, wherein I have a very modular cluster build out. Because of the tech, I'm able to build out these modular clusters, right? And then help these brands power differentiated milk sale to those consumers.
So who was your first customer to whom you started selling milk? Like, and, you know, how many liters was it when you first started selling? How many liters do you sell now? Like where the whole pipe is through you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So right now, maybe when we started, it was virtually unheard of customers, right? We used to take it to a local Horeca segment. And this is not by Horeca, I mean hotels, restaurants and catering, right? And these are not even large Horeca chains like Cafe Coffee Day or Starbucks. This would be some local guy because we had to get some basic volumes, right? But the whole point is if it was raw milk, it was just raw milk. So we would run the logistics. We would take it in tankers. Tankers would go and hand it over at a tanker level or at a can level, right? You'd have these Tata Ace-like vehicles taking these in cans and handing over the can levels. And the whole point, this Horeca segment is important for us when we started, was that if a Coke were to be a customer, the day one requirement would be 30,000 liters, right? How would you sell 30,000? But day one, I would only get 5,000 liters, right? So I could sort of dispose of this 5,000 liters to a local, you know, Horeca because they make 5,000 glass of tea and coffee or 10,000 glass of tea and coffee.
Yeah.
Right? So until my supply side scales, I just can't get. So my first set of customers were highly fragmented sort of Horeca. Then
and
we started,
what was the value prop for them? Like better quality or better pricing?
Yeah,
or?
Better quality. You could actually make more cups of tea and coffee with our milk.
Because
it is rich in fat, better yield and you know, all of that, right? And they would pay us more because they have seen.
Quality is
or
better.
It could be a sweet... it could be a sweet maker who makes koa, right? And he would tell, look, yes, my koa is the base for most sweets in India, right? So they'd say, yes, I'm actually getting more koa out of your milk. So I don't mind paying you extra, you know, kind of stuff, right? And then we started latching on to, you know, several big ones, right? So ITC became one of our big customers. So they buy, today as we speak, we are doing about 45,000 liters of milk flow per day.
Okay.
Right. When we started to reach a total sales of 1 million liters, which we started in July 2020 at the peak of COVID, we took about 250 days to touch a total of 1 million liters of milk, right? Today, we are probably, doing a million liters every month.
Every month,
Every month, okay? So by the end of this financial year, by March, we'll probably do anywhere between a million liters every 7 to 10 days, right? And our aspiration is to save a day every 3 to 4 months, which means in about 21 to 28 months, I should get to a million liters every day, right? If our supply ramps up at the speed at which we are in advanced discussion with several FMCG companies, including D2C companies like Zomato, Hyperpure, Swiggy Superdaily, Amazon Fresh, and you know, all of these guys. All of them who want to launch this differentiated sort of.
Are you still selling through like tankers, or do you also do packaging?
Packaging. So we have started doing some bit of packaging because our whole idea is we want to do this fairly end to end, right?
Because Big Basket would want packaged, branded, ready to sell.
Because Big Basket would pick up product, let's say from a dark store in JP Nagar or Koramangala in Bangalore, right? They wouldn't want to do anything until we reach that point, right? So we have to manage this entire cycle right up to that point. And then they would sell it maybe as a BB Royal cheese or, you know, whatever, right?
Are you making cheese also?
Just cheese, we have still not started. We have started doing a little bit of paneer. We started doing a little bit of yogurt. We will start doing a little bit of flavored milk, shortly. Cheese is still not on the cards yet. We'll probably start doing a little bit of ice cream.
Setting up your own processing units, or is it like third party?
Third party. Fundamentally, we are taking third party plants on lease, so that it's sort of an asset light model.
Okay. So you're operating. You're not investing in the land machinery, but you're operating.
We will take them and run it on a per month model, a rental model, or a per liter model, and then start. We think. We will start doing more and more value-added products because India is actually moving from a drink milk society to an eat milk society, right? Compared to Europe, where 90% of the population eats milk by way of cheese and other things, only 10% drinks milk. In India, it's almost the other way. About 75% of the population still drinks milk. Only 25% sort of eats. We think it's going that way because as the GDP of the country improves, people can pay more and more for paneer. Is a very good protein, right? As the protein consumption improves, over time, we think it'll shift more and more. So we think we have to get into more value-added, products because these FMCG companies, the good part about fresh milk, it's a daily velocity product, right?
Yeah.
They land up in, you get to see Amazon Fresh in front of your doorstep every single day. Which is good for Amazon Fresh because they're in your face in every single day, right? That's a daily. But then you also would occasionally buy paneer. You also would occasionally buy cheese. And you don't mind paying more because it is almond flavored or, whatever, right? So that's where you make your margin. So we are working on the entire portfolio. It's almost like a portfolio management, right? Which consumer needs what kind of portfolio at what point in time, where milk is at daily velocity, but then you also have all these weekly, monthly, quarterly buyouts, as well.
Okay. So, what all organized? So, ITC you said is one player. Well, ITC doesn't sell milk, right? They sell ghee.
They, No, they do sell ghee. Up north, they do sell a lot of milk as well. So they sell it in the Swasti brand, right? They sell
like Tetra Pak.
Yeah, they sell it as fresh. They sell fresh pouch milk.
Oh, they sell
right?
pouch.
It's called pouch milk, right? They do it in East today, right? Right now, I think they fancy the chances of like becoming the Amul of the East. They do that. Parle wants to launch its flavored milk. Right, we would want power there in a brand as well. Zomato has a two-pronged strategy. They would like to first supply milk and value-added products to their restaurants and cloud kitchens through the Hyperpure access, and then eventually also sell it direct to consumer, as well. Right, and all of us know that folks like Coke and Pepsi do want to get away from the sugary drinks to more nutritional. Talk to them. So for us,
like
the
they
demand
would probably also do like flavored milk rather than plain vanilla.
Flavored milk and differentiate themselves and all that, right? So, but for us, the whole point is that demand has not been a problem, and I think we are now trying to ratchet up our supply because at 45,000 liters, we have maxed out. We can't give more, right? I need to now deploy these pipes, right? The cold chain components, grade to price, and variables, and all of them. Across the chain. So that's the reason we've just raised a total $20 million type of a round right now. That's powering it.
This is the next raise after you did that raise in 14. This is the next one or between 14 to now?
In 2013, we did the raise from Omnivore. That's that money we used to...
the 7 crore raise.
That's the 7 crore raise. And then subsequently, of course, they did an add-on raise of another 10 crore and all of that. But all of it was done by Omnivore. They also probably felt that they gave us too little money. So they gave us some more in 2014. 2015, they gave us some more. In 2016, we raised a bunch of capital about 14, 15 crores from a combination of Bini Bansal. He used to be... the CEO of Flipkart
back then.
Put in some money in 2016. Bloom came in. Bloom, they normally do early stage companies. They were one of the earliest investors in a runner that got acquired by Zomato. Taxi for sure got acquired by Ola and all of them. So they came in there. Then we had Finded Startup who came in. It's a very prolific investor. Then we had a couple of Japanese investors who came in, like BNext and Arun Seed. And then we had another interesting company investor called Venture Highway who came in. Venture Highway used to be run by Samir Sood and Neeraj Arora from Google and WhatsApp, respectively. So these guys together, all put together, gave us about 14, 15 crores. That helps us scale up business to supply tech to the supply chain companies. And in 2018, we had very couple of more interesting guys come in. So we had IndusAge, which today is called Celesta, come in. They're again a Valley-based fund, but have an Indian presence. Gates Foundation came in. We were the BMGFs, Gates Foundation's first ever equity investment in India.
Okay.
Opera's, of course, they've invested in people like 1MG, which got acquired by Tata. Right? I, in fact, met Bill in 2016, Bill Gates in 2016. We were one of the four companies which presented him. So I had a 12-minute exclusive slot with him.
Amazing.
Which was a good experience.
Full circle, back in 97, he inspired you to become entrepreneur.
That's correct. Exactly. So he liked what we did, and then their investment team invested in us after all the due diligence and all of that. Then we had ABB Technology Ventures who came in at that time, and then Qualcomm, because there's a whole bunch of telecommunication and the
IoT
involved. They came in as an investor as well. And so these are the investors who came in now. Right now, we just closed around, this was in 2018, couple of months ago, we rose around Nutreco, as I mentioned, because the commerce part kicking in. And we are just about to also get someone like an IDH FarmFit to close this round for us so that it makes like a total $20 million in a type of round. They're like, the IDH FarmFit is like the Gates Foundation of Netherlands, because... No matter what, so we get a lot of undeserved attention for changing lives, right? That was not our focus, but we landed up solving the problem. I call it undeserved because I wish that was where we started, but we landed up in that sector. But so we get a lot of impact accolades, right, because we change lives. 80% of the dairy farmers are women. We are improving farmers' income. We are reducing carbon emissions, because if animals produce more, carbon emission goes down, because with fewer number of animals, you're able to produce more amount of milk. So though you're reducing methane gas emissions, because animals produce methane gas by way of regurgitation, flatulence and other things. So we're able to reduce that, right? Almost 60% reduction we're able to show.
Wow.
But all of those impact metrics were purely coincidental. I mean, it was not thought through. It's a byproduct of IoT journey that eventually started up becoming an FMCG, powering an FMCG journey. Mm. So we're able to attract a lot of the impact investment because we're able to, show income increase of an order of magnitude for the dairy farmers who come up on our supply chain. Because you pay $100 for high-end milk, it eventually has to flow back to those farmers.
Yes, right?
And
yes.
My fintech is taking it to the next level by making the, five-cow farmer to become a 10-cow farmer, because State Bank of India or ICICI Bank can't give them loans. Right? We see them loans because we see them every day. So that way, we're able to improve farmer income. We're able to give them market linkages. We're able to give financial inclusion. We're able to ensure that if you're a women farmer, you get better interest rates, because women farmers repay better.
Right.
Okay. They don't go get drunk at the end of the day kind of stuff, right? So we're able to get all of those. Mm.
Educate farmers with your app. Like the app would be giving them nudges on best practices.
Exactly. Do this, buy this nutrition. I'm actually giving you European grade nutrition, and it can help you produce more milk and all of that, right? So gender, financial inclusion, carbon footprint reduction, and income improvement, right? These are the metrics that we touch. And hence, we're able to impress upon folks like IDH Farm Fit or a Gates Foundation and Arun Seed from Japan to say, hey, look, it's a hard problem to solve, right? It's not a food tech in the city. It's not a platform or a marketplace that is urban-centric. It's not an urban-centric ed tech platform. It's a hard problem, and we need more patient capital. So we're getting that kind of investors. We're getting some really marquee investors like Qualcomm and ABB. And then we also get pure financial investors like Indusage and Omnivore and Bloom and all of them, right? So it's been a good mix on the table. We are in the market to raise more, because this is, as I said, it's a $225 billion industry.
Yes, yes.
Right? Three times the size of telecom market in India. I don't know if you knew that.
Okay.
Right? The dairy is three times the type of all the telecoms put together.
Wow.
Right? And you have 500,000 milk collection centers in India. Right? That's three times the number of post offices that exist in India. So it's a massive segment.
Right.
Right? And I think if we get enough capital, we can also replicate this blueprint globally as well. Right? Because milk is milk throughout, right? You have cows produce milk, people eat it or drink it, right? The idea is, how do I take this made in India blueprint to other
countries,
supply chains?
Right.
It could be Indonesia, it could be Southeast Asia,
Bangladesh.
We interestingly had a subsidiary in France as well. We were actually incubated by Business France in Normandy, just across the English Channel, where they said, look, why don't you try to replicate some of this in Europe using France as a base? By the way, Europe and France is well automated, but not digitized, right? So why don't you use this blueprint, adapt it? And we like the concept, because in Europe, people can pay more, right?
Yeah.
But then we realized that it needs more capital, because the cost structures are more expensive.
Yes, yes, yes.
We said, look, we will put it on hold.
And yours is a people-heavy business. Like, you need a lot of...
People-heavy business, exactly. People-heavy business. And we need a partner who OEMs and adapts it there, but then runs their operations themselves. But all of this needs capital. So we decided, look, let's make the unit economics work in India. Let's hit the ball out of the park in India. And then if we get enough capital, we'll start replicating this blueprint elsewhere as well.
Okay.
So that's the journey where we are right now.
So it seems to me that dairy is a supply-driven industry in the sense that demand is not a problem, supply is the problem. If you can get supply, you can sell. So,
correct.
As you increase your supply, wouldn't you be competing with the customers of your SaaS or your pure tech offering, like the other dairy companies who are just deploying your technology? Wouldn't you be competing with them for that same supply?
Yeah, no, good question. Good you are able to see through that, actually. So what happens is that the way this dairy supply side is split, right? About 25% of the milk is in the organized segment. 75% is still unorganized, right?
Okay. Like that doodhwala, like on the motorcycle. Exactly. Like I used to live in Noida. Exactly. So there used to be these guys in motorcycle coming to apartment complexes and measuring glass by glass.
Absolutely. I mean, so the 75% is, as you said, the guy coming in the bike to your home, the guy selling to the local sweet shop, the guy selling to the local marriage halls, or even domestic consumption and in all of that, right? Only 25% is the one that is coming through the Amul network or a Moomark network or a Stellabs network, right? So it's 25%. So thanks to the pioneering work done by folks like Amul, you at least have 25% of this in the organized segment, right? Look at fruits and vegetables. Fruits, vegetables, pulses, and all the other agri products, less than 5% is in the organized segment.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
Dairy is probably the crop where you have 5 times more in the organized segment than the rest of all agriculture put together.
Right.
I would give credit to Amul for actually having pioneered this cooperative.
Right.
Which other cooperatives picked up. And even private dairies have adapted these models for their benefit, right? So when we go into a village and compete for the supply side, right, you have enough headroom there to compete on the unorganized side. That's number one. Number two, this industry is known for its cohabitation. Okay, so what we've seen is while Nestle procures milk up north in Moga, down south, Heritage actually processes and procures milk for Nestle and their own brand as well, right? So we have seen that cohabitation is okay as long as I'm not competing on the consumer side.
Okay.
On the supply side, depending on who has what access, that's sort of okay. Number three, do remember that our gravitation and orientation is to work with brands, right, who do not have any inclination to get onto the supply side as long as they can get assured and traceable supply. Right? The Amazon Freshers of the world, the Britannias and the ITCs of the world, who have invested billions of dollars in building a brand, right?
And distribution.
And the distribution network, the last mile D2C distribution, right? They would rather leverage that than fight the battle on the supply side with the farmers and all the tech and all that. But we fancy our chances there, right? And the fourth one, which I think will play out eventually, is that we think over time, even if you're a backward integrated dairy-only commodity player, we'll probably become the cheapest way to source milk because we're doing at scale for multiple people in a multi-tenanted manner, right? This is almost like the ODC model that Wipro, Infosys, Cognizant, TCS.
What is ODC?
The Offshore Development Center model.
Okay.
Where they actually set up offshore development centers for these European and American companies, for the Ericssons, Nortels, Citibanks of the world, wherein you use a common factory model of engineers to service multiple customers without violating the intellectual property and all of them, right? So because at scale, you probably become the cheapest way to develop that software, right? Using that, onshore, offshore, that kind of model. So similarly here, we sort of become the best possible way to run the network. Right. This is also replicated since we come from a telecoms world. Today, Ericsson actually runs Airtel networks, right?
Yeah.
Right. They started off as selling the boxes to Airtel, but they run the network.
Airtel is only in the business of branding and marketing.
Exactly. Airtel is a retail company. The entire IT system is run by IBM, right? So Airtel is a retail company.
Right? Yeah,
it's actually an FMCG company.
Yes,
a retail company,
it is. Right.
So, but they didn't start that way, right? They started by running their own network. They started by running their own IT systems, right? But now they don't take care of any one of those. So I think the dairy industry and agri at large will move in that direction, right? Where you have people like Amazon, Dunzo, Jio, Reliance, who crack the consumer access, right, who cracked the last mile distribution, which needs billions of dollars,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
But then you need multi-tenanted, multi-service, traceable providers of any agri-produce, not just dairy, right? So I think that's the model it will go to. It's still early days because the telecom industry has had a lot of capital flowing in and had that maturity tenure to flow through this. Whereas agri industry will see this, you know, pan out with some tweaks, you know, over time.
Okay, okay. So what are the constraints for you to scale up supply? Is it capital?
So right now it is the right capital, the right talent, and the right execution, right? We need capital because I need to put out those cold chains, those IoT devices,
I need to build those pipes.
Second is talent, because it's very easy to look at this and people say, look, I'm building a dairy, right? And let me do it the brick and mortar way. We keep reminding people saying that we are not about milk. We are not about digital supply chain. And the agri inputs, financial services, and all of that are an incidental outcome of the digital supply chain. So all of you, so to that extent, I'm trying to become the de facto digital proxy or the default Amazon of dairy, right? So I need the leadership team, the execution team, the hands and feet on the ground to think that way, so that they don't think that they're trading milk from point A to point B. They're not trading nutrition from point A to point B. They're not selling cattle from point A to point B. They're not lending. They need to think that I'm a multi-service Amazon manager who is you know, leveraging this digital supply chain to sell anything and everything that any stakeholder in this chain wants, right? So getting the right talent.
So you need to have that startup culture in people you hire, rather
startup
than
culture.
The
exactly.
Cooperative. Like
brick and mortar, right? Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. That brick and mortar thinking can ruin us, right? So that constant talent engagement and driving home the point, and it all suffers from tan effect. You drive home the point today, in 1 month, they come back to their old ways of doing this. And the third is execution. Execution is hard because milk is a 24/7 industry. Starts at 4 a.m. and ends at 1 a.m. You get the milk no matter what at your doorstep to drink your tea and coffee every day. It's a rural-driven supply chain, right? A remote area where electricity is a problem. During marriage season, transportation gets hit, right? During Chhath, something happens. During Holi, something happens. It's politically sensitive areas,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
People like to play politics with this, you know, segment, right?
Yeah, yeah. You're vulnerable to politics, absolutely.
You're vulnerable to those. So that way, it's hard on execution. It's a crackable problem. So you just can't afford to take even 1 hour off your pedal on execution, right? So these are the three things. If you crack at scale, I think we have a pretty, a multi-billion dollar opportunity that we can crack.
So isn't the talent problem also like a tech problem only? Like, say, Amazon has like thousands of drivers, warehouse workers who are probably not on the payroll also, but then they have these pure automated systems through which the compensation is linked purely to performance. And, you know, it's like being a part of a machine almost for employees. And there are like a lot of complaints about working at Amazon, but they've solved that productivity problem through tech, like productivity of people. And
absolutely. No, you can hit a very, very pertinent point. So when things become very operationally intense, right? And especially if a personnel on the ground is supposed to render multiple services, right? The only way to do it is to do it in a tech way. Otherwise, it becomes too expensive, right? It's like saying if an Uber driver has to figure out where to pick up his next passenger from, tech has to assist him that there's someone 2 minutes away from it. And by the way, imagine that if he has to also deliver a pizza in that time through Uber Eats, within that comes in, right? So the only way it can solve the upskilling, cross-skilling problem can be solved is through this tech. And this is exactly the point that we were brainstorming last night with the leadership team here, on saying what are the features that our farmer app should support so that a farmer or the personnel tending to that farmer knows that it's not only about cattle nutrition, it's not only about A, B, C, it's also about Y. But he's not a PhD in all of those, right? I need to upskill and cross-skilling in all of this. And tech actually comes to fore, and it has to be highly dumbed down.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
For him, it has to be some pop-up comes, yes, I have to do this, right? And these people may not have the same level of commitment as someone who's in the city. So they have to be reminded of and do this now, right? If you're in a farm to fix an IoT device, ask the farmer, why didn't he pay the last month's EMI, right? He probably never did a EMI interaction before. He only had a screwdriver to fix an IoT router in that farm. He also has to do something more.
Right.
So that is something that you're working on. I'm not saying that we have, you know, cracked that, you know, problem, but it's something that, you know, we would, you know, want to crack. But that's something that would help us improve productivity and all of that.
Right. So when you are hiring these people who are all deployed at remote locations, how do you make them loyal towards the company? Like, because they would literally hardly ever interact with you, right? Because they would all be in remote deployments. So how do you do that engagement and culture building and loyalty building?
Yeah, so that I've very soon realized that after the financial component, the CFO office, the HR office probably plays the next, you know, most important, you know, role, right? And the way you engage an IT and tech engineer up here in Bangalore will be very different from the way you engage a personnel deep down in Eastern UP, right? So we try to do a lot of these talent engagement, productivity improvement, ongoing trainings, because no matter what good a software we write sitting here, no matter how much good your business plan looks on an Excel sheet and PowerPoint, the guys on the ground who can take ownership and drive it are the final who matters, right? So we are trying to sort of, it's very tempting not to invest in talent engagement and maybe put that money on an extra software engineer or an extra salesperson. But I think investing in the talent engagement, if we don't do that, we are about 750 employees today. If I don't do that, I think we'll get hit, right? So we're constantly trying hard, very, very tempting to invest that extra buck on sales or extra buck on a product feature. But investing in talent functions become extremely critical. Build that culture, drive on the fact that you're not running a dairy, you're a multi-service personnel, you're a branch manager, you're an Amazon personnel, right? Driving home that mindset so that they don't think like a cooperative, they don't think, that becomes very critical. And it may not result in upsides next day. It will result in an upside a month, a year from the now, or 2 years from the now.
Right,
so that's
right.
Sort of invest in that.
What do you see as your path towards becoming a unicorn? Like, you know, you are actively in the market to raise more fund. Like, what do you think will be the time when you'll hit that mark?
Yeah. So we think we should hit that mark anywhere between 24 and 36 months, right? From where we are, you know, right now. So as I said, we are actually building 4 potentially unicorn towers.
Yes.
Right? There's financial services piece, the tech piece, the market linkage piece, and the agri input piece, right? All of them powered by the basic foundational digital access network, right? So one of the questions that we get asked is, do we have enough management bandwidth to run all the 4 towers at the same time, right? So we're just trying to sort of first pick the market linkage tower, right? Because everything else powers that one tower,
yes,
right?
Yes.
As the tower picks up and we get more capital, we start nurturing the other 3 towers, right? So that's how we are thinking about it. So hopefully, if we have enough support from capital, execution, and talent, we should be able to get to that stage in 24 to 36 months.
Got it. Amazing.
This episode of Founder Thesis Podcast is brought to you by Long Haul Ventures. Long Haul Ventures is the long haul partner for founders and startups that are building for the long haul. More about them is at www.longhaulventures.com.
Before we end the episode, I want to share a bit about my journey as a podcaster. I started podcasting in 2020, and in the last 2 years, I've had the opportunity to interview more than 250 founders who are shaping India's future across sectors. If you also want to speak to the best minds in your field and build an enviable network, then you must consider becoming a podcaster. And the first step to becoming a podcaster starts with Zencastr, which takes care of all the nuts and bolts of podcasting, from remote recording to editing to distribution and finally monetization. If you are planning to check out the platform, then please show your support for the Founder Thesis Podcast by using this link, zen.ai/founderthesis. That's zen.ai/founderthesis.